Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 87, Kitchen Questions 2. Hey everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host. And as you know, this is the show that's all about home cooking, all about getting in the kitchen and having fun, trying new things, all that good stuff. You know, on my last episode, I was doing a cookbook giveaway for the Nerdy Nummies cookbook. You know, every time I say the name Nerdy Nummies, I feel so ridiculous saying it, but it is a good cookbook. Anyway, I had a lot of folks enter, and right as soon as I'm done recording this podcast, I'm going to do a drawing for the winner, and I will send that winner either a message on Facebook or an email, depending on how they entered. So if you're listening to this episode right now, be sure to check your email or your Facebook Messenger to see if you're the one I picked. All right. So it's been a while since I've done a pure dedicated episode on just questions that I've received. And I've received quite a few questions, I don't know, the last couple of months that I've been kind of corresponding with folks on email and sending emails back and forth. So I think all of these questions I've actually answered one-on-one with the person who asked, but they're all really good questions. So I thought I would put them all together into this episode of Kitchen Questions, and maybe we can turn up some interesting tips or tricks or things that you can use in the kitchen, because I think all of the questions that were asked are interesting, and I think they apply to pretty much anybody who's in the kitchen at home cooking. So we're going to get into that in just a second. I want to remind everybody also that if you want to find me somewhere outside of your ears, you can go to the page on Facebook at facebook.com/kitchencounterpodcast. You can find me on Twitter at TKC Podcast. And of course, you can always send me an email to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. And if you're looking for any of the show notes for this episode, you can find those at kitchencounterpodcast.com/87. What do you say we get into this edition of Kitchen Questions? All right, today's first question comes from Tammy. And Tammy wrote me just not that long ago, and I was debating making an entire episode about this topic, but I thought maybe I'll just tackle it in sort of this Q&A style, and then we'll see how that goes. And if it warrants more talking about it, you folks can send me an email and tell me to do it, and I will do it. But here is Tammy's question, and I'm going to paraphrase most of these questions just in the interest of time. But Tammy's question was this. She writes and was looking for some help because her husband is going to receive his master's in business. He's graduating the first weekend in May, and they're planning to have some family from out of town visit on a Saturday in the morning. And he has a family that will be attending, or family that will be going to their house afterwards for a party. So Tammy writes, I'm not good at party planning and it makes me nervous. We do budget, so don't want to spend a lot and want it to be more laid back, maybe grilling hamburgers, brats, etc. Any help you can give me would be greatly appreciated. And not sure if we plan lunch and dinner or mid-afternoon meal and snacks. They like to have adult beverages too. So she's going to have about 30 people between adults and kids. And she ends her email with, yikes, I am so nervous. Well, this is pretty exciting. You know, having a party with folks over for a special occasion is always a lot of fun, unless you're the host, in which case Tammy's right on the nose. It can be very nerve-wracking. So Tammy and I emailed back and forth a bit, and I had some ideas, but I got to thinking about this, and I even started writing out kind of what I was calling my quote-unquote laws of cooking for a party, and I kind of came up with a few ideas, and I was going to share some of those here without getting into specific menu planning or, you know, actual recipes or anything like that. I just kind of want to talk about my mindset when I get ready or I know I'm going to be needing to cook for a group of people. So my first point that I get into my brain, or I try to whenever I know I'm going to cook for a crowd, is that you have to understand that your guests have lower expectations than you do. And I don't mean to say your guests are a bunch of knuckle-dragging, mouth-breathing simpletons who don't know good food when they see it. No, what I mean is that, well, think of it this way. When you go to a party where it's just like a casual get together of friends or acquaintances or, you know, coworkers or even some people you don't even know, you know, what are your expectations? What do you hope for as a party goer, as a guest? It's probably something along the lines of, I hope I don't do anything that makes me look like a complete fool or say anything that makes me look sound like a complete fool. I hope I can find somebody interesting to talk to, and I hope I have a little bit of fun. I mean, seriously, those are pretty much my expectations. I bet they're the same as with a lot of people. When I host a party, what are my expectations? Oftentimes they're, wow, I want to create some really clever, interesting food that people are going to be talking about days after they leave the party. I want people to be laughing and joking and having tons of fun and all sorts of activity for people to do. You know, I want it to be an event for them to hopefully have a lot of fun and remember. So you can see right there, there's a bit of a disconnect. Like, the host's expectations are always higher than the guests. So it's a good reminder that you don't always have to plan the party of the century when you have some people over for some food. Your guests don't expect that. They just want to have some good food. They want to have some good conversations, and they want to feel comfortable. And, you know, I would also say regarding food, here's another well-known fact about food in general. And, you know, food almost always tastes better when you don't make it yourself. Have you ever noticed that when you spend a lot of time in the kitchen making some very, I don't know, fancy or time-consuming recipe, and then everybody sits down to eat it, and everybody else is raving over it, and they're telling you how great it is, and you're eating it, and you're going like, I guess it's okay. I mean, it's not that great. It's always your perception when you make food that it just doesn't, you know what went into it, you know what you were hoping for, and your expectations might not match up with what you thought the dish was going to be. People that are eating your food don't have those expectations, so it always is going to taste a lot better to them. So I only say this, you know, so you put your mind at ease. You don't have to be nervous about cooking for a group of people and what they're going to perceive your food to be like. Okay, another general rule of thumb that I oftentimes forget, but I try to keep in mind, is that this is a weird physical law of the universe, that on the day of a party, time flows 2 times faster. So inevitably, when you wake up and you're getting ready for your party that day, later that day or night or whatever, you will not have enough time before the party to get everything done that you wanted to get done. It's just a fact of life. You'll always end up forgetting something or leaving something off because you didn't have time to get to it, or you're doing some last minute house cleaning. You know, that's just the way it goes. So to that point, I say do as much before the day of the party that you can. So when you're planning your menu, try to make food that you can make some of the main components a day or two ahead of time and reheat the day of the party. That'll save you a ton of time. Do all of your food prepping, or as much of your food prepping as you can, also the day before, a couple of days before the party. Like, there's no reason in the world, if you're going to have like a veggie tray, that you should be the morning of the party sitting in your kitchen, you know, cutting up carrot sticks. You should have all of that already done. You can do that the day before and save yourself a lot of stress and time the day of the party. And the other thing I really like to do that helps me stay on track on a party day is take a page from the professional kitchens or the professional caterers, and take a sheet of paper, or if you have a chalkboard or a whiteboard or somewhere where you can write everything down that you need to accomplish that day, whether it's food related or otherwise. And then as you accomplish it, or you and your spouse or whoever's helping you, if hopefully you have help, you can cross it off as you go, so you can see what you still need to get done, and it helps you time, and it helps you avoid those situations where you get 10 minutes before people are showing up and you go, oh no, nobody made the guacamole. And you know, now you've got to scramble and do that. You'll know that because you've got everything listed out and where it needs to be when. All right, a couple other quick things about making food for a party. I don't know if you know this or not, but did you know that the more work you make your guests do at the party, the more they'll enjoy themselves? It sounds counterintuitive, but as I mentioned earlier, you know, nobody wants to be sitting around bored or not talking to anybody or not sure what they're supposed to do next, especially when it comes to food. You know, on a party, if you're the host and you have planned a menu that requires you to basically become a short order cook, you are going to have no fun at your party, and chances are a lot of your guests aren't going to have a lot of fun because they'll be sitting around waiting for food. Have you ever been to a barbecue, 20 people there, 30 people there, whatever, and they have this tiny grill, and they're making like 8 hamburgers at a time, and people are just like, you know, just starving to death waiting to get their hamburgers, and they're coming at like 6 or 8 at a time, and by the time everybody gets some food, the people that were in the front of the line ate like an hour ago. And the biggest bummer is whoever's doing the cooking, probably you. You've been standing over a hot grill the whole time. You haven't been able to enjoy conversations. You haven't been able to get people's beverages and greet people at the door and make people feel comfortable. So try to avoid becoming a short order cook at your party. And the way you do that, one of my favorite methods, and this is what I do at almost every get together, besides maybe, you know, more quote unquote formal holiday dinners, is I do buffet style and build your own style. And one of the things I mentioned to Tammy, because it's going to be close to Cinco de Mayo, why not have like a build your own taco bar or a burrito bar where you can make all of the components, most of it ahead of time, set it out in a nice, beautiful spread, and your guests, as they're hungry, can get up and assemble their own food. It's a lot of fun for them to do because they can make their food exactly as they want it. The folks with the food allergies and the dietary restrictions can avoid the things that they don't want to eat. They don't have to pick it out of whatever it is you hand to them. And it gets people up and talking and socializing. I mean, how many conversations have you been a part of at a party where you're standing, you know, by the food, dishing yourself up some munchies, and you're talking to whoever's there? You know, it's a much more social, much more comfortable and casual way to go. Like I said, I prefer to go that way, and it takes a ton of stress off of the host to do that. Now, you're probably thinking right now, well, how about some actual practical advice where you tell us how much food you need to plan for however many people that show up your party? There's a lot of ways you can calculate that, and rather than me going over that on this episode, I'm going to put a couple of links to two good guides I found online that will give you a great idea of what you need to do when it comes to food, calculating the quantity of food for your party. So I'll put those in the show notes. Again, that's at kitchencounterpodcast.com/87. So I hope that gives some ideas. Tammy, I know we've already kind of chatted back and forth about that, but that was kind of my thinking behind when you're cooking for a party, kind of where do you get your brain at, and what do you really want to worry about? Okay, next question. This one comes from Tara, and she says, my husband and I are trying to eat more healthy, and with springtime here, we're really trying to lighten up our dinners. We're experimenting with trying to eat more salads, but I find it's really hard to keep lettuce fresh for long after we buy it. How do you recommend keeping lettuce fresh for longer than just a couple of days? We don't want to have to buy fresh lettuce on the day we decide to eat a salad, especially if we're eating salad several times a week. Well, I suspect, Tara, that one of your challenges is that you're just probably not storing the lettuce that you have very efficiently or correctly. And there's one thing I would say about that, and it's not even really about storing the lettuce, but if you're buying, you know, I assume you're not buying the pre-bagged stuff because that stuff lasts for a long time, relatively, if it's, you know, unopened. I assume you're talking about fresh heads of lettuce or whatever, like green leaf lettuce, that sort of a thing. The key, I believe, to really good quality salads is getting a salad spinner. If you're not familiar with using a salad spinner or what one is, it's essentially, there's many styles, but essentially what it is, it'll be like a plastic bowl with kind of like a basket, like a mesh basket type of an insert that sits down into that bowl. And then you have this lid on top with like a lever or a handle or a crank or something. And it's set up in a way that when you press the lever down or turn the crank, the basket inside the bowl starts spinning, and it spins really fast. The idea being, when you put wet lettuce, or you can even use this for herbs, other things like that, when you put that in the basket and you give it a good spin and get it really, really whipping, the force of that spin kind of literally pulls all of that water off the lettuce. And then you can basically pop the basket out with all the lettuce, and then you'll have water left over in the bottom that you just dump out. And you can do that a couple of times. You'll probably be very surprised at how much water actually comes off your lettuce. And in fact, what I really like to use my salad spinner for is washing my lettuce. I'll actually fill really cold water into the bowl with the mesh basket in there. I'll put all my lettuce, you know, I'll break it up, I'll trim it up however I want it. I'll put it into the water, give it a real good swish and swirl, and then pull the mesh basket out, and then all the water drains and I can dump it. And it's really shocking, even when I think the lettuce should be relatively clean, how kind of brown the water will be when I dump it out. And if you've ever just tried to wash lettuce, like by hand, you know, you run under some cold water or something, and or you put it in a colander and you kind of rinse it, and then you kind of, I don't know, shake it off or something, you'll be shocked if you use a salad spinner how much cleaner your lettuce will get by doing it that way. Anyway, once you do that and then spin your lettuce so it's nice and dry, you're getting all of the moisture or most of the moisture out of that. Not only will it store better, you can put it, I usually put mine in like big gallon Ziploc bags, you know, maybe with a folded up piece of paper towel in there just to kind of catch anything else, any other moisture that's in there. Not only was that going to last a heck of a lot longer in your fridge, but it's going to make for a better salad, because I don't know about you, but salads with wet lettuce are kind of a downer because none of the dressing will stick to the lettuce. All your other ingredients are going to get kind of soggy. So it's nice to have really dry, fresh lettuce in that salad bowl, and a salad spinner is what can really do that for you. I'll put a link to a couple of salad spinners that I'm familiar with in the show notes if you want to take a look. Okay, next question is from Kyle, and Kyle wrote to me and was asking about kitchen knives. So to summarize what Kyle asked, he said, how much is too much to spend on a good kitchen knife? I want something that'll last, but I've seen some knives that cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars. Are these knives really worth it? Right now, I'm using a plastic-handled chef knife that I bought at Target last year. I think I paid around $20, and I feel like I'm ready for an upgrade. So Kyle went on to ask if I had any thoughts on if he were to upgrade, you know, what would be an appropriate kind of next step for a knife. And this is a pretty good question. And truth be told, I'm of the belief that your knife, your at least one of your knives in the kitchen, is probably in the top two or three of tools in your kitchen that you should really try to go as nice as you can. Because with your kitchen knife, you're going to be doing the lion's share of all your prepping tasks with a knife. And if you can get a good, say, a chef's knife, which is a great versatile type of knife, could do a lot of different tasks from large to small, carving, chopping, dicing, all that kind of stuff. If you can get yourself set up with a decent quality chef's knife, you're going to have that thing for years and years and years. It's going to serve you very well. I personally think, and I've said this before, I think on the show, the biggest bang of quality for your buck when it comes to kitchen knives, I really like the Wusthof Classic series. So my favorite knife in the kitchen is a simple 6-inch chef knife. It's a Wusthof Classic. I think it costs, you can get it on Amazon, depending on sales and stuff, between, I would say, $79 and $99, which sounds like a lot of money for a knife, but it's a really quality instrument, and it's going to stay sharp for a long time. It's going to serve you well for a long time, and you're going to really learn that having a good quality sharp knife in the kitchen is really a blessing. It's a lot safer to use. Your prep is going to go a lot faster, and it's just, it's really a go-to instrument. So I would say if $100 sounds like it's an investment you would make if you're going to be spending a lot of time in the kitchen cooking, then I would go with one of the Wusthof Classic chef's knives. Henkel's is another pretty good brand, I would say, about the same tier of quality as a Wusthof. Once you get above that, there's a lot of different types, and there's a lot of boutique brands. Are they good quality knives? Yes. Are they worth hundreds and hundreds of dollars? Maybe. But I, as a home cook, don't really see the need to go there. So I hope that helps. Well, here's an interesting one. Now, this one comes from Caroline in Utah. And I think this is probably a situation that several people find themselves in. But Caroline said, outdoor cooking season is here. I'm seeing more and more cooking shows and magazine articles on barbecuing and grilling and that sort of a thing. but we live in a small apartment with no access to a barbecue. Is there any way we can take advantage of all of the barbecue stuff that's coming out without using a grill? Is there a way to approximate a barbecue indoors? That's an excellent question. I think it's very interesting because, you know, barbecue is one of those methods of cooking. First of all, it's different in a lot of different places, and you can have arguments with people for hours on what constitutes a real barbecue. I mean, let's face it, if you're not in the back with the giant steel rig doing your brisket and your ribs, you know, low and slow with real hickory wood, I mean, anything beyond that, it's like, what degree of not barbecue is it? My point being that we all do things that we consider barbecue and grilling, but, you know, there's more to it than just the technique. There's the flavors, the type of seasonings and sauces you use, different cooking techniques, of course, different cuts of meat, different vegetables even. And there's also the social aspect to it, right? Having a grill out in your backyard is as much about getting together with friends and drinking a beer and, you know, talking and having a good time as it is about cooking food. So I certainly would say don't let the fact that you can't get outside with a grill, you know, on a regular basis discourage you from embracing all that quote-unquote barbecue has to offer the home cook. So my initial thought would be that you have probably an oven in your apartment and you probably have a broiler setting in that oven. And that's about as close to an actual outdoor grill as you can get inside the kitchen. Certainly, there's not going to be an element of smoke or smoking to it. But if you think about a gas grill, for example, what is it but simply direct heat? You know, that's all it really is. And that's exactly what a broiler is. The only difference is you're not setting your protein or whatever it is you're broiling directly on a grill grate above the heat. You're setting it on a broiler pan right below the heat. So just a simple example, if you want to grill chicken breasts, but you don't have a grill, you know, go ahead and season them up, put some rub on them, whatever you want, and throw them under your broiler element. And you're going to get a pretty close idea of what it would be like to grill them anyway. A couple things about using a broiler. You have to be careful about whatever bakeware it is you're going to decide to use for a broiler. You really probably want to stick to the broiler pan that came with your oven, or go pick up a broiler pan if you don't have one. That's that weird looking two-piece pan where it has like a dish on the bottom, like a metal dish or a pan, and that weird slotted lid that goes on top. That's a broiler pan, and that's safe to use under a broiler. It can handle the heat, and it channels any fat or grease or oil or anything like that that's on your food down into the pan as it cooks and away from that really close source of high hot heat of the broiler element. So broiler pans are a way to go. You can do cast iron under a broiler fairly safely. But definite no-nos would be like glass. Never put glass under a broiler. Teflon, anything like that, because a broiler element is really hot direct heat, and it can ruin a lot of your bakeware or cause it to warp or crack. The other thing that a lot of people aren't aware of with a broiler is that because it is direct heat, you're not relying on the temperature of the oven to cook your food. You're relying on the direct heat of that broiler element. And, you know, all ovens have a thermostat in them, right? So when you bake a frozen pizza, for example, and you set your oven at 425, it preheats to 425 degrees, and then you put your pizza in the oven because you want your pizza to go in, or whatever it is you're baking, cooking, to go in an already hot oven, and then it's in there for 20 minutes or whatever. But it's using indirect heat, right, to cook whatever that is you just put in the oven. So a broiler uses direct heat, and broilers are usually set by default at 500 degrees. So if your oven hits 500 degrees and you're trying to broil something, your broiler will actually turn off, just like your baking elements will in an oven. And then all of a sudden you're not broiling with direct heat. You're essentially baking whatever it is you put under the broiler. And this is not real common, but if you're going to broil something right after you've baked something in a hot oven, let's say you just made a pizza at 425 and now you want to throw something under the broiler, well, your oven's going to get up to 500 degrees a lot faster than if it started at room temperature. So if you're broiling, you don't want your broiler element to go off. So what you can do is you can actually make sure there's no kids running around or getting in near the oven, but you can actually prop your oven door open while you broil. It's not going to hurt that you're losing heat, because you're just losing ambient heat from the oven. You're not losing the heat from those broiler elements. And if you do that with your door open, it's a lot less likely that your oven's going to heat up to a temperature where your broiler shuts off. So, yeah, you can use a broiler to do pretty much whatever you'd want to do on a grill. But like I said, you're not going to get any smoke or anything like that. You might get smoke from whatever it is you're broiling, but I mean smoke, like if you wanted to smoke something in a barbecue, that's, you know, it's not impossible to do inside, but usually the trouble's not worth it. Okay, I think I have time for one more question. Let me grab my list. Okay, here's one. Naomi writes, she had a question about bacon. And you know, shockingly, I don't think I've ever really talked about bacon on the show. Not at least as far as cooking it or preparing it. But Naomi wants to know, she says, my husband and I have been trying several different ways to cook bacon. Most of them are really messy and leave our entire house smelling like bacon. What is your favorite method to cook bacon, and is there a way to reduce the mess that comes along with it? Well, I do love my bacon, Naomi, and I have tried tons and tons of different ways to cook bacon. For most of my life, I just did the basic, you know, stovetop in a skillet. Probably the messiest way to cook bacon, because all the bacon grease splatters as you cook it. And what, you can only cook, if you have a really good-sized pan, you can cook maybe five or six slices of bacon if you're lucky, but probably more like three or four at a time. If you're cooking a lot of bacon, that just takes forever. So the method that I have pretty much gone to without fail, it's basically what I do for all the bacon I cook. Basically, I do bacon in the oven. Really simple, really effective. You get your like a large baking sheet or a large cookie sheet. It has to have a rim, okay, because you don't want any of the grease that's going to come off that bacon to slide off the side and catch fire in your oven. And I simply lay all the bacon out. I put it pretty close together. I can usually get a whole package of bacon. Like if you get the supermarket package of bacon, you can usually get an entire one of those into one of those baking sheets. I put the sheet with the bacon in the oven, right in the middle oven rack, and then I turn it on to 400. I don't preheat the oven first. So put the bacon in, turn it on to 400. You know, depending on how crispy you like your bacon, how hot your oven runs, you might need more or less time. But I typically shoot for about 15 minutes or less. I find that usually by the time the oven gets up to 400, the bacon's pretty darn close. When you pull the bacon out, just one quick thing, you got to kind of be careful, because if your bacon's pretty fatty, a lot of that fat and grease is going to be in the pan. So you want to definitely use two hands, pull that pan out very carefully. Don't tip it or tilt it, because you might lose some of that bacon grease. But you pull it out, grab your bacon, you know, drain it off, and you're good to go. And then you can just either pour that bacon grease into a can or something like that. Or usually what I do half the time is I forget to do that, and it solidifies before I have a chance to do anything with it. And then I wipe it out with a couple of paper towels and toss it in the garbage. So that's my favorite method to cook bacon. It's, you know, you still have a lot of grease, but you don't have the splatter. You don't have that kind of mess. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, your house is still going to smell like bacon. Great question. Appreciate it, Naomi. All right. I think that'll do it for the questions for this episode. Well, I've got a few more questions to cover, and I think I'll probably have a few more coming in over the next couple of weeks, so I'm going to leave it there for now. I have a few more in the bucket for next time. But thank you so much for tuning in and listening to this episode. As I mentioned, right after this, I'm going to draw the winner for the Nerdy Nummies cookbook giveaway, so check your emails or check your Facebook, because if you're the winner, I will get a hold of you that way. All right. Well, everybody, I just want to say happy springtime. I'm so glad that the rain and the cool weather here in Oregon, at least, is almost behind us. The sunshine has been giving me a serious case of spring fever. So I'm really excited to work on some episodes coming up about outdoor cooking or springtime meals, that sort of a thing. If, as I said before, you want anything from this episode, you can go to thekitchencounterpodcast.com/87. Or if you'd like to send me an email, you can do so at feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. Of course, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter as well. All right, everybody, that's it for today. Until next time, I am Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy cooking.